From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the predictions of psychic Dr. Lewis Turry. Here's what's happening. In Chicago, the country's third largest school district has canceled classes as 25,000 educators plan to walk off the job on Thursday. The Chicago Teachers Union demands reflect what teachers across the country have been clamoring for: smaller class sizes, more support staff, higher raises. We'll see what happens. U.S. retail sales fell for the first time in 7 months in September, raising fears that a slowdown in the American manufacturing sector could be starting to bleed into the consumer side of the economy. That's not good news. This is, though. General Motors and union leaders at the UAW have reached a tentative deal on a new labor contract that could end the United Auto Workers' month-long strike against the automaker. Details of the proposed deal not immediately available. However, the union's roughly 48,000 members with GM are expected to receive raises and bonuses as part of the accord. They will vote on the pact. Here's our registered investment advisor, Mish Sedlak. Mish, this is good news if they ratify this contract.
It is, George, and I'm looking at raises of 3-4%. I looked at the stock market reaction today. GM was up 2.5% and only closed up 1%. Ford was flat on the day. I just wonder about some of the details, though, George, and we're just guessing. I'm reading these reports, so we don't really know what's in there, but they're talking about the addition of 9,000, you know, more workers, a path for promotion, faster raises. George, if the economy is slowing down, I don't know how we can guarantee these jobs because we don't know what's going to happen with the cars and the auto industry. So, yes, it's good this is over. It cost GM $2 billion so far. It's probably going to take another 2 weeks to hash this out. But if GM agreed to something that's going to destroy its bond market and its bonds are already, one company has them rated as junk, it's not good from that aspect, George.
Well, we will watch and see what happens, but I'm glad it looks like this strike is over once the workers ratify. Social isolation is unfortunately a common occurrence among the elderly. While this phenomenon can be traced back to a number of contributing factors, the simple fact is that it's harder for many older people to move around, and it plays a significant role in relationships. With this in mind, researchers from the American Geriatric Society said they may find a link between osteoarthritis, a condition that causes joint pain, and social isolation. That's interesting. Many people, of course, suffer from stress, anxiety, and depression during the winter holidays. One of the reasons why our programs are live 7 days a week for you. The truth is, the holiday cheer isn't guaranteed just because it's forced on you by television specials, social media posts, and Christmas carols in every store that you step in. Several sources can cause a storm of negativity during the holidays, from money stress to family stress, and from pressure and unmet expectations to loneliness. Let's check in with resident psychiatrist Dr. Peter Bregan. Peter, how widespread is loneliness and depression during the holidays?
Oh, people often just feel miserable, George, during the holidays. And I just love that you bring this subject up at the holidays and that you stay on the air. One of the problems is that the psychologists, the therapists themselves are adding to the misery. Here's one that says, recall your favorite holiday movie when the family felt the meaning of true Christmas, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, that was fake, says the psychologist. Huh. Totally Hollywood fake. I want to tell people that you can make your holiday. You know, of course it's depressing if you have to go and see the people who brought you up in a way that left you feeling really angry, upset. Of course it's no fun to go to a party where you know one of your uncles is going to, you know, try to be inappropriate with you sexually or put you down. And sure, it's no fun if you have no place to go on a holiday.
True.
But The answer is to remember we have to make our lives here on Earth. There are infinite opportunities. There are times when holidays can be as good or better than movies. So sit down with the person that's nearest and dearest to you and say, what do we do to make this a great holiday for us or for some friends or for some other people or some people who are poor or don't have meals? And then you get into all the guilt and shame. Well, we have to go to Uncle Jack's party. We have to see Mom. There's no way not to see Mom on Christmas or whatever else. But I want to urge you folks out there to really look around and say, well, what do I need? And if you actually don't even have somebody to sit down with and plan, then go someplace where there will be people who will need you.
Mm-hmm.
Go to someplace where you'll be giving out food on Thanksgiving or Christmas or cleaning up or helping in some way. We can make our holidays. I want people to know that we humans can really go out there and get the love we want, give the love we want, find the enjoyment we want. I want folks to have good holidays.
You got it. Thank you, Peter. We'll be talking with you before those holidays. And once again, we will be live for you on Christmas Eve and Christmas night, New Year's Eve and New Year's night, Thanksgiving night as well, just in case you're by yourself. NASA has unveiled a new spacesuit for the next moon landing. I don't know when the next moon landing will occur, but we've got the story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. If you get a moment, go take a look at it. It's kind of a cool space suit. It really is. Archaeologists have discovered more than 20 ancient wooden coffins near Luxor in Egypt. According to the country's antiquities ministry, the coffins were found on the River Nile's bank. It's pretty fascinating story indeed. Another fascinating story, of course, has been the disappearance of the former Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa. In a moment, Jack Goldsmith joins us with his work in Hoffa's shadow next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We've got a fascinating program for you tonight, starting, of course, with In Hoffa's Shadow, Jack Goldsmith, a professor at Harvard Law School, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, co-founder of Lawfare. He teaches and writes about national security law, presidential power, cybersecurity, international law, internet law, conflicts of law as well. He's from Newton, Massachusetts, and his book is called In Hoffa's Shadow, A Stepfather, A Disappearance in Detroit, and My Search for the Truth. Jack, I'm looking forward to this. Great book, by the way. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Here's something for you that is a tidbit that I think you'll enjoy. I'm from Detroit. I ended up my career at WJBK Channel 2 before I left on to Minnesota, then St. Louis and L.A., and I may have been the last news person in 1975 to talk to Jimmy Hoffa. It was in May of 1975. I had invited him to our station to be on our newscast. We had an hour-long newscast at the time. And so we had big blocks where we had live interviews on the set. And he was one of them. And
what was he like?
I like the guy. And, you know, after the newscast was done, I walked him to his car that he had parked in our back parking lot. His whole effort was, as you well know and point out in your book, In Hoffa's Shadow, he wanted to come back and reclaim the union presidency. You know, his parole, you know, he said that he couldn't do that, part of his terms. But, you know, he was a nice guy. But, you know, I've got some questions about him and Kennedy, and we'll get into that. But the big story that we were covering during those days is, of course, what happened to Jimmy Hoffa in July of 1975 when he was going to have a luncheon with some mafiosos at the Marcus Red Fox in Bloomfield, and he was gone. But the big story, and this is where you come in, is that we all were told or heard that his pseudonym son, the guy that he treated like a son, Chucky O'Brien, who I believe was your stepfather, was the driver at the Marcus Red Fox and took him away to whatever happened to him. Tell me a little bit about what you've heard, because you had a falling out with him, and then you came back into the family mix again. And then, of course, wrote the book In Hoffa's Shadow. But tell us your story with this, Jack.
Yeah, so I was 12 years old when Hoffa disappeared. My mother actually married Chucky 6 weeks before Hoffa disappeared. So Chucky had just recently come into my life. He was my stepfather. He was actually a great father. As you pointed out, he was Hoffa's longtime aide. He had been his right-hand man for 20 years. They had had a falling out about 6 or 8 months earlier, before the disappearance. And soon after the disappearance, which, as you said, took place, Hoffa just disappeared into thin air from the Moccas Red Fox parking lot. About 5 or 6 days after he disappeared, my stepfather became the leading suspect and the person whom the FBI believed at the time picked him up from the Moccas Red Fox and took him to his killers.
Yeah, that's what we kept hearing. That's what our reporters at our station were trying to follow that lead. Chucky, I believe, he's still alive, isn't he?
He is.
He's got to be what, 80-ish?
He's 85. He'll be 86 in December.
I mean, and everything we heard, Jack, during the 70s was that, you know, he's got a son who's running the union now, James P. Hoffa. And I met his daughter, Barbara Kranzer. She was a judge here in St. Louis. She's in her 80s right now. But we always heard that Chucky O'Brien was like a son with Jimmy Hoffa, that Hoffa loved him like a son. And some of us had a very difficult time trying to accept the fact that was he really a suspect? Did he drive the car and take Hoffa to some place where they, you know, rubbed him out? And some of us couldn't believe that he would do something like that unless they also threatened Chucky.
Right. So Chucky was like a son to him. He referred to Hoffa sometimes as dad. Hoffa referred to him as his second son, his other son. They were extremely close. Chucky was by his side all the time for the 20 years leading prior to the disappearance, except for the few months before. The reason that the main reason the FBI believed Chucky was involved was because he was driving a car in the vicinity. It was believed, since Hoffa disappeared into thin air, that he must have gotten into a car voluntarily with someone. They speculated that he might have gotten into the car with Chucky, that Chucky was one of the few people he would have gotten into the car with. Chucky was very close to one of the other leading suspects, Anthony Giacalone, and the FBI also discovered what was later determined to be a hair that matched Hoffa and the scent of Hoffa in the car. So there was a lot of circumstantial evidence pointing to Chucky. As you said, Chucky revered Hoffa. He viewed him as a father. He loved him like a father. And all of my life, he treated him, he revered him and told me how much he loved him and expressed deep affection for him. The circumstantial case against Chucky that seemed so powerful in 1975 and that the FBI released at the time, which is why everyone believed it, they actually accused him publicly of driving Hoffa to his death. The circumstantial case against him, what I'm about to say now is not known. The case, as the public understands it, basically rests on the 1975 rumors of the 1975 theory. Starting about 20, 25 years ago, the FBI developed a whole bunch of reasons to think that Chucky wasn't involved, that the circumstantial case against him was full of holes, and they developed evidence to think that there were other people involved. So he's basically, as you say, everyone thought, was told that Chucky was involved in 75. Everyone was surprised since he was so close to Hoffa. But that rumor and that representation by the government has been out there. Book after book has repeated it in various guises. But the whole case has changed in secret. The government hasn't talked about this publicly, but the whole case has changed in the last 20 years.
I bet it has. We'll get into some of those cases. You did have a falling out with Chucky. Something happened where you kind of broke away. What happened?
Yes. So I was extremely close to him when I was a teenager. He was an amazing father. In the height of the Hoffa investigation, he was an amazing father. When I went to college and to law school, I began to reflect upon Chucky's impact on my career. I started to read books about the Hoffa disappearance. It turned out that many of the gentlemen that I was hanging out with who were Chucky's friends, like Anthony Giacalone and Anthony Provenzano, two men that I referred to as Uncle Tony and Uncle Tony, that they were, according to the books I read, very dangerous and violent men. These books told me that Chucky had a criminal past. So I started to learn more about my stepfather, whom I revered, and I started to think about my career. I wanted to be a lawyer, and I assumed, and this was a valid assumption, that having a close association with someone associated with the mob and who is the leading suspect in the Hoffa disappearance might not be so good for my career. So largely for what now seemed to me to be pretty selfish reasons, I basically cut him out of my life for about 20 years.
Well, and you were an assistant attorney general, weren't you?
I was the assistant attorney general in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel, yes.
At what point did you decide to break bread with Chucky again and get close to him?
It started actually when I was in the Justice Department. I was working on what President Bush's warrantless wiretapping program.
Okay.
And I had discovered that there were some legal problems with it. In the course of working on that program, I actually came across accidentally some precedents involving Chucky, in which Chucky in the 60s had been illegally surveilled. He had always told me that you couldn't trust the government, that the government did all sorts of illegal surveillance, that they cut corners in secret inside the Justice Department. And it had an impact on me when I was in the Justice Department involved in just such a program, and I came across an opinion that basically validated what Chucky had long told me. That was the event that got me started to rethinking him, to reconsidering him and trying to basically seek his forgiveness. There were other things as well. As I got older, I became less judgmental. I became less confident in my own virtue and somewhat less confident that I was in a position to judge Chucky and his life. I had my own young children, and it was only after I had children and the love and vulnerability that came with having children that I realized how extraordinarily hurtful I had been to Chucky when I basically cut him out of my life. So for all those reasons, I sought his forgiveness after I left the government.
Have you had a chance to talk to Chucky over the years about this Hoffa case?
Oh, yes. The book is basically about that. We talked for literally hundreds, probably certainly more than 1,000, maybe more than 2,000 hours. We talked and talked and talked for 7 years about it.
Does Chucky have his own theory of what happened and who did it?
He's never told me what his theory of what happened and who did it. I mean, early on in our discussions, he was floating theories about the CIA and the like, but that wasn't serious. He's never told me who he thinks actually committed the deed that afternoon. I don't think he knows.
Maybe he doesn't want to know, Jack.
Well, he certainly doesn't want to know. He told me that many times. He said that. I quote him on that in the book. He says, "I don't know, and I'm glad I don't know." And certainly, if he did know, he wouldn't be alive today. There's no way he would be alive today because he spent the last 45 years trying to clear his name. He's talked to the FBI. He's been on television. If he had any evidence to spill, he wouldn't have been alive today.
Now, for a lot of people, of course, who weren't around during the Hoffa era, he was a bulldog. He helped build that union when this country needed unions because most companies were taking advantage of American workers, and he threw a lot of muscle, got his way in, but using some of that muscle, he had to go to the mob to get some help, and he stayed in bed with them and financed Las Vegas with Teamster pension money and God knows what else they did and got to a point where, and we'll play a clip after the break of Bobby Kennedy from the McClellan Commission who was going after Jimmy Hoffa. But Hoffa was very friendly with mobsters, and I think that was probably his biggest undoing, Jack.
I agree. I agree with both things you said. He was a hugely important and hugely successful labor leader. And he came up through the labor movement the hard way. And he was enormously consequential in bringing many hundreds of thousands of people into the middle class. Yeah. And the workers and the teachers union and many other workers around the country just revered Hoffa. So he was really an amazing leader. But as you say, he was also what can only be called corrupt by any definition. He did have relationships with the mob. They were of two sorts. One, as you say, there were a lot of mob-controlled unions in the Teamsters Union when he became president, and he basically had to accommodate those. He did not have the power to basically get the mob out of the parts of the union that they controlled. And Hoffa was a very pragmatic guy, and he was willing to deal with anyone on any terms if it brought him some advantage. So he had no compunction about dealing with the mob-controlled unions. And then also, as you say, and this was the real relationship, he used the Teamsters Pension Fund to make loans to all sorts of people, including organized crime.
Absolutely. He built Las Vegas. Jack, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with you. Jack Goldsmith with us in Hoffa's shadow. We are talking about In Hoffa's Shadow, Jack Goldsmith's incredible work about Jimmy Hoffa. He is Jack is the stepson of Chuckie O'Brien, who many had accused of being involved in the Hoffa disappearance. And we've been talking about that and much more to talk about when we come back. We'll also take your phone calls next hour with Jack as we talk about the Hoffa case. And welcome back to Coast to Coast with Jack Goldsmith, his book, In Hoffa's Shadow. And, Jack, I have to tell you, I know about half the people who were called before the grand jury when they started investigating his disappearance. Your book is one of the most thorough ones that I have ever read on the subject.
Thank you.
It's just truly remarkable. I want to get your reaction to the movie, The Irishman, with Al Pacino and De Niro and all those folks that's coming out with, based on the book I heard you paint houses. But for people to really get a handle on why Jimmy Hoffa disappeared and, as we can say, murdered, he wanted to come back into the Teamster presidency. But by that time, his handpicked successor, whom he didn't get along with anymore, Frank Fitzsimmons, he was in bed with the mob as well, and the mob didn't want to make a change. And I guess Hoffa, and he told me this too when I was walking to his car, he knew that we all knew his reputation, and he wanted to go straight. And he was done being the bad guy with the mob, and the mob wasn't going to have anything to do with it. They had their hand in the cookie jar, the Teamster Pension Fund, and they didn't want to make a change. I believe that's why Hoffa got killed. What do you think?
That's exactly why he got killed. One of the things that's important to understand is that while Hoffa did have extensive relations with the mob, when he was, and I explain this in detail in the book, when he was in charge of the Teamsters, he was in charge of the pension fund. Chuckie described this to me in detail. The mob would come to him. It would cost them $50,000 per loan just to be considered. Hoffa often said no. He often said yes, and they needed him because they couldn't get the funding any other way. He often said yes, but he sometimes said no. So while Hoffa had these extensive relations with the mob, he was in charge of the Teamsters pension fund, and he often said no. When he went to jail, as you say, he placed Frank Fitzsimmons in charge, and Fitzsimmons was a weak sister, and he basically allowed the mob to take over the pension fund. All hurdles to the pension fund went away, and the mob was gorging on Teamsters pension fund, pension money. And so when Hoffa gets out of jail and tries to come back, they basically said, no way. And as you say, Hoffa was threatening for the last 6 months to basically reveal, he was overt about this, to basically reveal everything he knew about the mob's relationship to the Teamsters and the like. I'm not so sure. He said he was going straight. I'm not sure Hoffa was really capable of going
yeah.
Great. But on the other hand, he did threaten to tell tales, and there's just no doubt that that organized crime around the country was mortified. I talk about this in detail in the book, and that's certainly why he was murdered.
And what's so amazing, his son is now the president of the Teamsters Union, and he's been the president for 20-some years at least.
Yeah, much longer than his father.
Yeah, and a good guy. And his daughter, Barbara Crancer, was a St. Louis County circuit judge. Very well-educated, good kids.
Yeah.
In 1957, and this is part of the problem that started this mess for Hoffa, Bobby Kennedy, who was an attorney on the McClellan Commission, as they were investigating racketeering and mob involvement and stuff in unions and everything else. Bobby Kennedy hated Jimmy Hoffa. And Jimmy Hoffa, as you know, Jack, hated Bobby Kennedy. I want to play a little clip of Bobby Kennedy trying to question Jimmy Hoffa at the McClellan committee.
I am not controlled by him, but by the same token, I do not intend to go around and abuse the provisions of the Constitution of the International Union, of which you accuse Mr. Beck of doing by having dictatorial powers. Now, I want to be able to follow the Constitution in due time.
You can
this situation will be cleared up. If you recall, I took office almost just about February 1. I went through a long trial in New York, which tied me up. I had a question of the monitors, which tied me up. And I haven't had much opportunity to do the normal duties that would have taken place if all of the various incidents hadn't came about during my short period of time as general president. In due time, these situations will be cleared up.
Mr. Hoffa, that would make a great deal of sense. I'd be very sympathetic if it wasn't for the fact that a majority of these people are in the Central States Conference, and people under your jurisdiction. You've got people in Detroit, at least 15 who have police records. You've got Joey Glimko in Chicago. I say you're not tough enough to get rid of these people then. You're in with every gangster and hoodlum in the United States.
I know a lot of people in the
United
States.
You're in with every place that you go, you're associated with the leading gangsters and racketeers in the United States,
Mr.
and it's
Kennedy.
Not so shocking that you should be involved in taking the Greenleaf money.
Mr. Kennedy, it is shocking to even involve a man with that kind of blood taint money. And I don't go for that, Mr. Kennedy.
Well,
I don't go for that kind of action.
Well, then you could have arranged that, not going for that kind of action, by disassociating yourself many years ago from Joe Costello.
Why?
You could have done it from
Mr.
John
Kennedy.
Vitale. Every place you go, we've checked your telephone numbers. You're calling every gangster in the United States.
Mr. Kennedy, what has happened life of people today may be different.
You got Lieutenant Shoulder's son working for the Teamsters Union.
They
St.
may
Louis.
Be nice people today. You don't give them a chance to prove they're nice. They may be nice people.
So as we know, Jimmy Hoffa was involved with the mob, involved in a big way. Bobby Kennedy went after him. Eventually, Jimmy Hoffa went to jail during the Nixon presidency. He was pardoned. And part of the deal was he would not regain any union activities anymore, even though that's what he wanted to do. That's what he told me and so many other people back in 1975 when he was starting that push that got him killed. I'm convinced, Jack, now you've looked at this and you've touched upon it in the book, and you mentioned the fact that there's no proof, and I agree with that. I think Jimmy Hoffa, who hated the Kennedys, had something to do with John F. Kennedy's assassination. That's always been my personal feeling.
Well, I couldn't find any evidence for it. He certainly hated Bobby Kennedy. He hated his brother. As the House investigators in the 1970s, who did a rerun of the Warren Commission, said of Hoffa, he had the motive and he had the means, but they couldn't find any evidence that he was involved. Chucky told me a lot of intimate things about Hoffa, and he insisted he wasn't involved in it. He was certainly happy when John F. Kennedy was killed. But I don't believe that he was involved for any number of reasons.
He knew the players who may have been involved, Carlos Marcello and Sante Traficante.
He did. He also knew Jack Ruby. Everyone who was in Detroit knew Jack Ruby.
Yep.
And so he definitely knew the people who were for whom there's a more plausible case of involvement. But I found no evidence that he was actually involved. And he was under, at the time this was happening, he was under 24-hour surveillance. He knew he was under 24-hour surveillance. And it just would have been surprising if, even though he wanted it, he was happy that it happened, if he were involved. But in any event, neither I nor the investigators were able to find any concrete evidence suggesting that he was involved.
I think part of Hoffa's thoughts were that if you get John F. Kennedy, the president, out of the way, his brother Bobby, of course, will stop being the attorney general that he was.
Yeah, I quote Chucky. Chucky told me that soon after John was killed, he said, one prick gone, maybe we'll be lucky with the next one.
Did Chucky go into deep depression when Hoffa disappeared?
Chucky, as I describe in the book, was... The moment he heard about that Hoffa went missing, he was mortified. because he didn't know what happened that afternoon, but he knew why he disappeared. He knew all the players all the way around. He knew Hoffa, he knew Giacalone, he knew Provenzano, he knew all of them. So he immediately knew what happened. And it was mortifying to him because his two father figures were Jimmy Hoffa and Anthony Giacalone, the person who had disappeared and the leading suspect of the disappearance. And he was then soon, when he became a suspect, which freaked him out because he wasn't actually involved in it, but there was this strange circumstantial case against him, he became even more freaked out because he wanted to try to clear his name. He tried to clear his name, but he couldn't even begin to do anything to cross the mob, because if he had, he would be a goner also.
Oh, absolutely. What's so amazing?
He was in a terrible, awful position, which I try to describe in some detail in the book.
And you do a very good job with that. What's so amazing, too, with all of this is the fact that this Hoffa case remains open. At least in the public's eye, it hasn't been solved. And the body has never been found and probably never will be, Jack.
I don't believe it will ever be found. I interviewed a lot of FBI agents who've worked the case over the last 45 years. So all the ones I could find who were alive. I actually became friends with a lot of them. We grew so close. And they all say the remarkable thing is there's a lot of evidence in the case about the conspiracy and the like, but there's actually not a single piece of evidence, not one, about what happened to him that afternoon. We have no idea what happened to him that afternoon. We don't know if he voluntarily got in a car, if he was shot or hit over the head. He just disappeared into thin air. There's no evidence. It's amazing.
You know, in some bizarre way, you know, we put him on Detroit television in May of 75, talking about the presidency and coming back and everything else. And then, of course, he disappears in July. I've always wondered if that broadcast anything to do with his disappearance.
It might have contributed to it, but he was doing a whole bunch of things. He was on other, it might well have contributed to it, depending on what he said, but he was letting it be known in public and in private that he was going to tell tales. I speculate in the book why he did that. I mean, it was obviously suicidal. He understood what the consequences would be. And I talk about Chucky's theory about that. I think that when he realized he couldn't get the teamsters back, he loved that union, he built that union, it was his whole life. And when it became clear to him when he was lost his case, he couldn't get the condition lifted, I think he just decided to bring everything down. And he wasn't overtly suicidal, obviously. He didn't take his own life, but he was acting in a way that foreseeably resulted in his murder.
Incredible story. Truly remarkable. Now, there's a book out called I Heard You Paint Houses, which talks about hitmen. And then it's, of course, been turned into a movie, which is going to come out in November, December, called The Irishman, about Frank Sheeran, who you highlight in your book as well. Sheeran, I guess, has said that he killed Hoffa. What do you think of that?
I don't think much at all. I wrote a long essay in the New York Review of Books. I think the Sheeran confession is preposterous, and so does everybody who's ever looked at the case in the FBI. There's no affirmative evidence for it, and the case itself is full of holes and implausibilities. But you can't prove a negative, and he did purport, according to the book, to confess to the crime. But I don't know anyone who's spent a lot of time looking at the case who believes it, and in that essay, I talk about the FBI agents on the record who think it's preposterous and why.
And it's
going to be made into a big movie, so it's going to be considered truth.
It's going to be a big one, absolutely, with some superstars in there. I remember cases where the FBI dug up a farm, where they dug up boards in a house, where all kinds of things. They just can't find it. Do you think there's some FBI person out there, Jack, who handled the case, who knows what happened?
Oh, not only do I think it, I know it, because I've talked to them all and they told me what they think. So I can tell you this about what they think what happened.
Okay, today. I'd love to hear it.
I mean, I can't reveal everything that I know because for a lot of reasons, but I can tell you this, and I talked about this in the book. Starting about 2025, none of this is known. The public, what I'm about to tell you is not known because the public thinks that the 1975 story that was leaked that involved Chucky and the like is the actual story. But starting about 20 or 25 years ago, two things happened. One, The case agent on the case and the assistant U.S. attorney on the case developed a whole bunch of reasons to think that Chucky was not involved, and they came to the view that the focus on Chucky had misled them and taken the case in the wrong direction. So that was one thing that happened. And starting in the 1990s, they tried to clear Chucky's name, and that's a whole thread in the book. At the same time, they uncovered through surveillance and through informant information, they believe they'd have figured out who did it and who picked Hoffa up and who killed him. The person that they think who picked Hoffa up, according to, again, this is according to several FBI agents and former FBI agents and at least one government lawyer who told me this, and I pieced it together based on what they told me. They think Vito Giacalone, who was the brother of Anthony Giacalone, who was a leading suspect, was the person who picked up Hoffa. Hoffa knew him. He had been talking to him in recent weeks. And he had no one knows where Vito was on that day. The FBI was never able to figure out where he was on that day. They think Vito picked him up, and they think that they know the man who killed him. And I did not mention the man's name in the book because I don't know the basis for the FBI's belief, but they think it was a low-level Detroit organized crime figure who rose in prominence soon after the disappearance and became a big man in the Detroit family. So they think that they have got it figured out, but all of the players are now dead. They can't prove it. I think one day that they will, maybe one day soon, they'll come out and finally explain what they know and why they think it. And I hope when they do that, that they exonerate Chucky because they've told him that they don't think he's a suspect, and I wish they would say so publicly.
That must have, the fact that he believes that he had nothing to do with it must have destroyed him during that time period, because every media vet kept saying, Chucky O'Brien, maybe he was the driver. Jimmy knew the driver, so he had to jump in with Chucky. It was all over the place.
Imagine how bad it is. This is a man that you grew up with, that you revered, that you were deeply loyal to, that you considered to be your father. And imagine if you had a reputation, whatever else his reputation was, and Chucky had a mixed reputation, but he had a reputation for loyalty, especially to Hoffa. That's why a lot of people speculated he was Hoffa's illegitimate son. I don't believe that's true, and I explain why in the book. But imagine that you're accused in public from the outset of the disappearance of actually picking up and driving your father to his death, patricide, essentially, and living with that for 44 years, trying to clear your name and not being able to. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to try to figure out the truth, because Chucky wasn't able to, you know, didn't have the resources or the legal training and the like.
Right.
To figure this out.
Do we know what the son, James P. Hoffa's views are about the Chucky O'Brien accusations?
Well, from the outset, James P. was convinced that Chucky was involved, and there's a long rivalry between them going back a long time. And they, from the very beginning, James believed Chucky was involved, and he was the one that first pointed the FBI to Chucky.
Interesting.
I don't know what he thinks today. I reached out to him twice to talk to me about the book, and he didn't want to talk to me about it.
I would guess there was a little rivalry there, as you say, because Jimmy Hoffa also thought of Chucky as his son and probably paid more attention to Chucky than he did James P. Jr.
He did for most of his life, yes. First of all, Chucky was extremely close to Barbara and James. He, in effect, raised them both. He was especially close to Barbara, and he loves Barbara very much. He and James had a falling out, but you're absolutely right. For most of James's life, most of Hoffa's attention in public and elsewhere was given to Chucky, even though Chucky was not a perfect human being, but Hoffa showered attention on him. But over time, after Hoffa got out of jail, as James's legal skills became more relevant to Hoffa trying to get out from underneath the condition of the pardon, Hoffa publicly and otherwise grew closer to his son, and he grew less close to Chucky.
Good point. Hold on for a second, Jack. We're at the break. Top of the hour, we'll come back and talk more about your work in Hoffa's shadow. And, of course, the website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's jackgoldsmith.org. And we will take your calls next on Coast to Coast AM.